Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out on this balmy January day. So if someone asked you, what is Buddha? What would you say? Not to put you on the spot. Anybody want to be brave? What would you say? Yeah.
Equanimity, compassion, love, and joy personified.
Yeah.
He was a man who lived a long time ago.
Yeah. The awakeness of the present moment.
Teacher?
Figment of my imagination.
That too?
My aspiration.
Aspiration?
Mm-hmm. Everything and everybody, including especially problems.
There we go. Look at all that. Well, a long time ago in China, a Zen monk named Dame asked Zen Master Matsu, what is Buddha? And Matsu answered, this very mind is Buddha. This is a very short koan. That's it. That's the whole koan. And it appears in the Mumon Kan, which is a collection of 100 koans, translated often as the Gateless Gate. It also appears in another collection of 300 koans made by Dogen Zenji, who's the founder of Soto Zen, our stream of Zen in Japan. And koans, of course, for those of you who might be new to that word, are short Zen teaching stories. They're little stories. They're often encounters, dialogues between a Zen monk and a Zen master. And sometimes, though, dialogues between a Zen master and an old lady selling tea by the roadside who trips up the Zen master. So there are stories that nudge us out of our conventional dualistic way of seeing the world. So I wonder what your reaction is when you hear that statement, this very mind is Buddha. Or another translation, mind here and now is just Buddha. Or simply mind is Buddha. Or the line that we chant sometimes in one of the chants that we do, which comes from the Rinzai Zen tradition called Hakuin Zenji's Song of Zazen. And the line goes, this very place is the lotus land, this very body the Buddha. How do you feel when you hear those phrases? What's your response? Just like a word.
Connected.
Yeah.
Aliveness.
Hopeful. Yeah, aliveness. Did somebody say hopeful? Yeah.
Relief.
Relief. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't want you make you feel bad, but Dame was instantly enlightened. But of course, that's a convention with these old stories, you know. And upon that, so-and-so was instantly enlightened, hearing that. But at any rate, something in him opened, something shifted, something was relieved, something was hopeful, something was, you know, all those words you just said. When I first heard phrases like this, when I first encountered Zen and Buddhism's practice, I felt a sense of expansiveness, of releasing that mind that clenches around the self. And I had a sense that I'd known this all along. Some of you had that sense when you first encountered these teachings that, oh yeah, I knew this. I've always known this to be so. I grew up in the countryside of New Jersey. Now for any of you who've only seen New Jersey from the New Jersey Turnpike leaving New York City. This might sound like an oxymoron, countryside of New Jersey, but in fact it was. It was countryside. I lived on a wooded hillside overlooking a small town with a farm next door. I spent hours and hours as a child roaming the woodland and the overgrown, unused pastures that extended beyond the 7 acres that my parents had bought a chunk off the edge of the farm. In the center of the little town was the white clapboard Baptist church I attended throughout my childhood until the beginning of adolescence when I exited. I have a memory of being quite young in the field above our house, among the buzzing insects, among the wild daisies and Queen Anne's lace, looking out over the woodland and the valley and the human habitation small in the distance. And knowing without words that all this was God's mind, that God was not some being out there somewhere that created all this down here, but that all this was in some way a vast mind. And even to me, as a little girl, that was a relief. It was a kind of freedom to know that God was not some old guy in a long beard up in the sky whom I had to obey or else. And this sort of inner knowledge, I think, was not always enough to keep me from excluding myself from the true freedom it might have offered. You know, there was a lot of conditioning in my environment, my family and my environment, that mitigated against that. And I certainly have struggled mightily with what it means to be a human being in this world. How do you live in this world in a way that's non-harming, in a way that's beneficial to other beings in the world? But I do think that those childhood moments were kind of touchstones, you know, that probably gave me some protection from the excesses of self-harming that I might otherwise have resorted to in those days. I don't think my childhood experience is particularly unique or special. Children, at least those who have enough basic safety and some freedom to explore the world on their own, you know, really as with some sense of solitude, which I think is more and more rare for children these days. Children who have that will spontaneously go to where they can be quiet and peaceful when they need to. And I think children have direct access to a sense of connection between self and world. Aunt and me. Robin and me. Different and same. Children get that. What is Buddha? Aunt, Robin, me. So Mumon, Japanese, woman in Chinese, was the person who compiled this collection of 100 koans. And he has a commentary. He comments on each of the stories. And his commentary on this one is, if you can grasp the point directly, you wear the Buddha's robes, eat Buddha's food, speak Buddha's words, take Buddha's role. That is, you yourself are Buddha. So when we, in any moment that we grasp this point, funny, the word grasp, of course it's ungraspable, but sometimes the word is, the grasp is used as, yeah. But when we experience this point directly, we are Buddha. However, he goes on. He says, Dame, that was the one who asked the question, however, misled quite a few people into trusting a broken scale. What do you think he means? By asking this question, getting this answer, he misled people into trusting a broken scale. And then he continues, "Don't you know you should rinse out your mouth for 3 days when you utter the name Buddha? If you are genuine, you'll run away holding your ears upon hearing the words, 'This mind is Buddha.'" So that's kind of the way I feel about the word spiritual. And I have a hard time bringing myself to use the word God in any meaningful way. Talk about trusting a broken scale. That's what he's talking about. The word God has become quite a broken scale in our culture. So I can see how a woman would feel like running away, holding his ears, after hearing too much talk about Buddha this, Buddha that. It makes it hard to give Dharma talk sometime. You've got to speak it. And it's inexpressible. So I think Wu Men and the old Zen masters and I too we're being a little facetious here with that kind of comment. The Zen masters love to tease. These old Tang Dynasty Zen masters love to tease us. But they're cautioning. They're just cautioning. Don't grab on to these words that we use for what's vast, for what's inexpressible, and make concepts of them. If we use them lightly. Hold them lightly. This version or translation of the Mumon Khan has little commentary essays by Robert Aiken, who was one of the earliest Zen teachers, American Zen teachers, lived to quite an age and died a couple of years ago. And he says, there are three phases in our relationship to these big concept words. You know, emptiness, Buddha, the big concepts of spiritual practice. There, I said spiritual. You know, it's like, what are you supposed to call it? He says, first, these words are meaningful. Next, they become brittle. And finally, they break into pieces and disappear. He says, this is because from the beginning they have been without essence. Use them, but don't be used by them. So I think those are wise words. There's a follow-up story to this koan. It's actually another koan in the Mumon Khan. And Dogen Zenji tells it in more detail in a fascicle or section of his masterwork, The Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, Shobo Genzo. And this section is called Continuous Practice. So I'm going to read from his section this follow-up to the story. So first he reviews. He says, when studying in the assembly of Mazuf, Fajang, Anyway, same guy as Dame. They all have more than one name. He practiced on Mount Dame, so they're often called by the name of the mountain that they practice on. But his other name is Fajang. So Fajang asked, "What is Buddha?" Mazu said, "Mind itself is Buddha." Upon hearing these words, Fajang had realization, as I said. Fajang climbed. So after that, he climbed to the top of Mount Dame and dwelt there in a hut. He ate pine cones and wore lotus leaves, as there were many lotus plants in a small pond on that mountain. He practiced Zazen for over 30 years and was completely detached from human affairs. Without paying attention to what day it was, he saw only the green and yellow of the surrounding mountains. These were rugged years. During Zazen, he set an iron stupa of 8 kun in height on his head. It was like wearing a jeweled crown. As his intention was not to let the stupa fall, he would not sleep. This stupa is still listed as a stored treasure in the Huisheng Monastery. He practiced in this way continuously without slackening. So, you know, here we are. We come to Zendo a couple times a week. On Wednesday nights, we're studying a text called Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage with Michael, written by another Chinese, old Chinese Zen master. And we're talking about how to nourish our inner hermit, even if we can't go to the mountain for 30 years. How can we nourish our inner hermit right here in our daily lives? After many years, a monk from the assembly of Yangguan went to the mountain looking for wood to make a staff. He lost his way and after a while found himself in front of Fajang's hut. Seeing Fajang, he asked, "How long have you been on this mountain?" Fajang said, "I have seen nothing but the green and yellow of the surrounding mountains." The monk said, "How do I get off this mountain?" Fajang said, "Follow the stream." Mystified by Fajang, the monk went back and told Yangguan about him. Yangguan said, "When I was in Jiangxi, I saw a monk like that, but I haven't heard of him since. That might be him." Yangguan sent a monk to Fajang and invited him to come to the monastery. Fajang would not leave the monastery, but responded with a poem. "A decayed tree remains in the cold forest. Meeting springs, there is no change of mind. Woodcutters see me, but I ignore them. How come the woodmaster seeks me out?" So he stayed on the mountain. He wouldn't go down. In fact, he decided he was going to move even deeper into the mountains to become less accessible. So he wrote this poem, "Wearing lotus leaves from this pond, inexhaustible, eating pine nuts from several trees, still more left." So in other words, my practice is inexhaustible. I could stay here and keep practicing. "Having been spotted by people from the world, I am moving my hut further away." So he moved his abode. So these old Zen masters used to send poems. This is a way to communicate. It was sort of like slow Twitter. Send messengers with a poem. Receive another poem back. So Mazu, his old teacher from the first story, heard about this and sent a monk to Fajang to ask him, "Reverend, when you studied with Mazu, what did you understand that led you to live on this mountain?" Fajang said, "Mazu said to me, mind itself is Buddha. That's why I am living here." The monk said, "Nowadays Buddha Dharma is different." Fajang said, "How is it different?" The monk said, "Mazu says, beyond mind, beyond Buddha." Fajang said, "That old man always confuses people." Let it be beyond mind, beyond Buddha. As for me, mind itself is none other than Buddha." The monk brought Fajang's response back to Mazu. Mazu said, "The plum is ripe." In other words, in another translation, it's, "The plum is ripening," which I kind of like. You know, this is his old student, you know, his practice is ripening. The Chinese probably doesn't make that distinction between ripe and ripening, but it probably just says plum, ripe. But ripening is nice. You know, we're all ripening slowly, slowly, wherever we are. So Ma Zhu was pleased with Fa Zhang's answer. And eventually Fa Zhang did come down and off the mountain and teach. The Heart Sutra says, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself form. Physicists say light is a wave and light is a particle. Eiken Roshi, in his commentary, says, this very mind is Buddha, is the starry sky. Not mind, not Buddha, is the empty sky. Dogen Zenji, in his Instructions to the Zen Cook, says this, handle even a single leaf of a green in such a way that it manifests the body of Buddha. This, in turn, allows the Buddha to manifest through the leaf. Handle even a single leaf of a green in such a way that it manifests the body of Buddha. How would you put it? So just in case you're sitting here thinking, what is all this form and emptiness? You know, what does this have to do with my daily life? Well, it does. It does have to do with our daily life, our everyday life. And I'll suggest how. There are three... first, I just want to ask you, how many of you have had a, what we could say, an afflictive mind state in the last few days? Is there anybody who hasn't? Oh, that's right. Okay, in the last week.
I don't know what you mean by
afflictive. Okay, I would say afflictive mind states are mind states which make us suffer. Hmm. Yeah. Anger, anxiety, fear, envy, despair, grief.
Okay, now you can ask us again.
Okay. Is there anybody who hasn't had an afflictive mind state in the past week? I mean, sometimes you get a week, you know, without any. If you're a fortunate and easygoing person. But, you know, most often, even if they're just little ones, and sometimes they're big ones. And our practice is a lot about how we meet those arisings of what we could call afflictive, or we could call them the dark or destructive states, mind states. I'm calling them mind states because they're a combination of emotion and thought. You could call them emotions, but that's not, they're really the actual physiological experience, you know, the clutching at the throat, the sweatiness, the heat, all the, you know, the actual emotional experience. Emotion means we're going into motion to respond to our environment in some way. So that experience, and then all the thoughts that go with those states, and they feed each other. It's not the thoughts cause the feelings, or feelings cause the thought. It's a feedback loop. And sometimes that loop spins us into a very deep habitual rut. And here's where our practice comes in. So the three ways, and I'm going to skim over the first two because the third is the one that really relates to our koan today. But the first way is to be fully, mindfully present with a state that arises in us. To feel the feelings, to notice the thoughts, without trying to push them away, without judging them, but also not holding on to them, so that we are fully present with the arising and the passing away and shifting of these states. We stay present and experience them. Just that, what we, you know, shining the light of awareness on our states, our mind states, often helps us to loosen our grip, to see them as the insubstantial and ephemeral, you know, transitory states that they are. It slows us down enough that we can be more easeful with the arisings and the passings of these states, which are conditioned. They're conditioned states. So that's what the first way. The second way is sometimes these states get really persistent, and simply being mindful doesn't seem to be enough. Sometimes they can be even toxic, and so with a toxin you need an antidote. So you can apply specific practices as antidotes to these states. And our Buddhist practice offers a wonderful array of practices. Loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, joy, patience, gratitude, generosity, determination. And there are specific ways that we can practice each of those qualities and cultivate those qualities as specific antidotes to specific states. So just as an example, say you're really suffering from a state of envy and resentment towards somebody. They've got what you really wish you had, and they don't seem to deserve it. So you might apply first a practice of simply kindness and compassion towards yourself in your suffering, as you're suffering from this, and with a sense that so many other people are suffering in a similar way. You know, it's not just you. This is a common way we suffer. And then you might apply a practice of what's called sympathetic joy, which is really feeling a sense of cultivating a sense of happiness in the well-being of that other person, as though it's no different from your own. And that's not an easy practice. And the other practice you might apply as an antidote is a practice of gratitude. Of gratitude for what's in your life that you really appreciate, just as it is. So there are specific antidote practices that we can use with these difficult emotions, states. But the third approach to practicing with difficult, afflictive mind states is when we become aware of the state, simply turning it, opening it up, letting it go, opening it up. And it's hard to even put a label on this, but it's when we penetrate, cut through our delusion of world, me against the world, you know, of our separate self. We open it up to the vastness of our connection to the world. And this is not something that we can really force or argue ourselves into, because if we try and argue ourselves into it, probably the mind will just resist and push back. There's a sort of alchemy to this. There's a sort of way that we, if we have practiced so that we can be open, to, even in our suffering, we can be open to almost a surprise, as though we're the in one of these Zen stories, and something turns us, and we open, we drop away that sense of constricted, separate self. And that's where I think these old stories have a role to play, almost as though they plant in us a seed. And that little seed gestates, germinates in the darkness, you know, not in our conscious mind so much. And so it's ready to kind of spring into the open, spring into the light, and just shift our and open our view. And that's the third way of that sometimes we can spontaneously shift, turn our deluded mind states. So that's how I've found these old stories work inside me, you know, at levels that I'm not necessarily conscious of. So I hope that they may start to work in you as well. In these koan collections, the person who compiles them, in this case Wu Men, usually offers a verse in response to the koan. So the verse from from the first one, "This very mind is Buddha," this is the verse: "The blue sky and bright day, no more searching around. What is Buddha, you ask? Hiding loot, you declare your innocence." I'm just going to read these. And the one, his verse in response to "not mind, not Buddha" is: "Present a sword if you meet a swordsman. Don't offer a poem unless you meet a poet. When speaking, say one third of it. Don't give the whole thing at once." So it's really easy for one old Zen story to lead to another. There's the one about the Zen master on a cold day who took the wooden Buddha from the altar and made a fire of it to warm himself up. That's the kind of irreverence that you find in these old koan collections. But I'll take Wu Men's advice and not give the whole thing at once. I've already gone over one third of it. So I'll leave you to see how these old stories resonate for you in the coming days and months and years of your practice. Just as the monks of old did. Yeah. So thank you all. Thank you all for listening.